Dark Reef Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 7, delivered on September 8, 2009. The title of this lecture is Essentials of Accounting.
Today, Essentials of Accounting. This lecture covers what we need as far as accounting knowledge goes. And when I say we, I refer to financial analysts, financial managers, financial planners. We do not do trial balances, debits and credits. We don't do that. That's the job of the accountants, and it is difficult work, and they are paid well for it. They usually are the last to be gotten rid of because, by law, public firms have to have accounting statements that are audited and are in proper order. However, we do want to know how the financial statements have been created. We want to understand the process. Not down to debits and credits, not down to the trial balances. We need to know what these financial statements mean and what the where the numbers came from. The textbook says there are three financial statements, and these financial statements are the income statement, the balance sheet, and the sources and uses, statement of cash flows. However, I'm going to tell you this from a real financial analyst's point of view. That is absolutely incomplete. There is a fourth financial statement, and it is way too often ignored, but it is very important. It is the notes to the financial statements. It is the notes. In those notes, there is a lot of information, background, detail, that is very important to a financial analyst who wants a complete picture of a company. And I will say this out of turn. I have known accountants, good accountants, who have actually used the notes to the financial statements to convey knowledge, information, I should say, that they could not convey in the three that I listed there. They were essentially signaling investors, signaling regulators. This is something that is interesting. Notice this, and I'll go to my grave, always going to the notes to the financial statement, sometimes first, before I even look at those three statements. I want to see, first of all, what kind of detail is in the notes? Are they just formalities, or do they get down to interesting talk? What is being said in there? I can tell you, as a matter of fact, I prepared financial statements, and in the notes, I signaled investors as to issues that I thought were problematic that were not being conveyed properly in the financial statements themselves. Certain things about how the owners were accumulating stock for themselves. I did that once, and then the accountant who certified these statements, he was very glad, he agreed with me, and he certified them. He said, I'm glad you said this. I didn't know this. This is important. And there was no way, there wasn't any way to convey that detail of knowledge. As it turned out, the company died after a few years because the owners were just soaking up, using a trick in stock registration called an S-8 to get stock for themselves, and then they were selling it off to the public. And it was just disclosing in the notes of the financial statement, at least I warned the investors that there was a kind of interesting game that was being played. But these are the three, the income statement, the balance sheet statement of cash flows. When we do financial analysis, though, and we will do some financial analysis in this class, I want you to always get those notes and look at them. Just read them. You don't have to be a brilliant genius for sometimes a little light to go on, or, wait a minute, that's kind of an odd thing right there. I wonder what that means. You might even ask me about it. What does this mean? And I say, well, I'm not sure. A lot of times I'm not sure, but it might merit some further investigation. Okay, these statements are merely numbers on paper. They don't do anything unless we can turn them into real, actionable knowledge. Then that's where we have to blend the data and the information together with what we know to create something meaningful. Here we go. Look, public companies, which is what we focus on in this course and in many courses, public in finance at the undergraduate level, public companies must report to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Under the Securities Act of 1933, under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, they have to report. Now, the first report, the seminal report that a company does when it becomes a public company would be a registration statement. A registration statement. It's OPUS. We are a public company, or we are now becoming a public company. Here we are. Here is our information as we step into the public light and ask the public to invest in our company through equity, through common stock offerings. Now, that the registration statement itself can be of different flavors. The big, huge, ginormous one is called the S-1 registration statement. It is to offer lots of common stock of a big company, the S-1 registration statement. I did one in my life, and I was qualified. In other words, the SEC said go. The SEC never approves a registration. The SEC never approves a registration, nor does it approve any of the amendments thereto. It will qualify them if they meet the guidelines. If they meet the guidelines. So there is no such thing as the SEC approving anything whatsoever. They will review it to see that it meets their standards, technical and otherwise, and if it does, then they will qualify it. The first registration statement I did to take a company public on a big S-1, they send you back deficiency. Deficiencies. You submit the registration statement, and then the reviewers look at it, and they send you back, well, these are your deficiencies. Try again. My first deficiencies facts was there were a total of 400 and some deficiencies. I almost had a heart attack, and I called an old consultant. I said, I really screwed up. He said, how many? And I said, it was something like 437. He said, not bad. What? Yeah. Believe it or not, a lot of them were just stupid little tiny technical things cleaned up. Second time, it was down to like 18. Third pass, it was qualified. That was the coolest thing. It tells you how lame my life is. It was a real rush. An S-1 registration statement. Uh-huh. Who's good? This is what New York lawyers do. I pulled it off. Now I can't do that. It's against the law for non-lawyers to do those now. But then there's smaller ones like an SB1. There's a registration statement called an SB1 that you can do. And then there are these private offerings of common stock. They're sort of like exemptions. And what happens is you can't trade that stock publicly. The people who bought it, they can't trade it publicly because it was like a private offering. You got all kinds of exemptions and disclosure. But eventually, you can take this company public and make that stock that is already out there public. And that's where we get to a special kind of registration statement, which takes a company public that already has stock outstanding. It's just not freely tradable stock. This is called the Form 10. Now, the reason I pay particular attention to this one is because of these filings that come after it. Now, the Form 10 is a registration statement that takes a company public that has standing stock. It's just that the stock can't be freely traded because the company hasn't been qualified by the SEC. Now, whether it be by Form 10, S1, SB1, or whatever, once the Form 10 opus has been set forth to the SEC for public analysis through the EDGAR system and through other means, every company must file each year a Form 10-K. This, and I describe it like this. The Form 10-K is the continuing amendment series. The Form 10-Ks are the continuing amendment series to the initial registration statement, be it a Form 10 or an S1, SB1, what have you. In other words, every year, a public company must file a statement saying, this is what has happened during this year, so that you can walk through the company's public life from its initial registration statement, perhaps on Form 10 or otherwise, and see as time goes on the progression of this company as these filings come in to amend the initial statement. Now, during the course of the year, the company will file Form 10-Qs. There will be, these are the quarterlies. These are not definitive. These are not definitive. The company does have to meet good, strong standards, but it is the K, the one that is the accumulation of the year's 10-Qs, four 10-Qs, that will be the definitive statement. So when you are looking at a company, analyzing a company, the first thing you might want to do is, if it's relatively new, you might want to have a look at its original file registration statement, an S1, a Form 10, SB1, whatever it would be. And then you start looking at the 10-Ks. For the current year, up to the time of your analysis, you'll also want to look at the Form 10-Qs. Be careful. If you're going through EDGAR, you'll see this list, like a maze of all kinds of different numbers. There will be 10-Qs, 10-Ks, 8-Ks, all kinds of oddball things of different letters and numbers designations. Make sure, if you are looking at 10-Ks, you make sure that there aren't any 10-KAs that came after a 10-K. You might look at the last 10-K and then not notice that there was a KA filed somewhat later. That would be an amendment to a 10-K that would essentially flag that there had been something, an error or an addition or a supplemental, something that needed to be said beyond the normal stuff. Okay, so be careful when you're looking at financial statements. There's this desire to attack the K's. Look at the K's and Q's. But notice the 10 KAs as well. Look at the KAs. Look for KAs to see if there was something that was amended afterwards. You might be surprised at an error. Sometimes the SEC goes back. Remember, the SEC is not approving anything. It's qualifying. The SEC reserves the right under its regulatory authority to go back later and review something that has already been filed and start bitching about it, saying, fine, it filed, but that doesn't mean that it's right. I can tell you right now, I used to be an EDGAR filing agent a long time ago, back in the early days of the EDGAR system, which I'm sure you all know about, at least to a small extent, and it essentially, as long as you had all the tags set up right, little tag, opening header, little tag, closing tag, it's like HTML markup. As a matter of fact, it is actually SGML, standard generalized markup. But as long as you got everything technically right, you would submit it and it would be come back to you. You get your ticket saying you submitted, it came through in good order. And that would be the end of it. There was no review by anyone. So those things pop up, or at least certainly in the old days, they popped up for people to look at in the Edgar system. Oh, they filed. Yes, it's on the SEC site, so it must be right. No, that was not how it worked at all. It was just a technical, if it's up there, that meant that all the tags were set right. And then from there, the SEC might go back later and, well, wait a minute, that's not good, what you did there. And then they might say, you need to file a KA, or a company might voluntarily file it. Let me give you one more that's a useful financial statement. Not a financial statement, I'm sorry. These are in the realm of the sphere of quasi-financial statements. This one, 8K. Were any of you taught up to this point in your business training about the 8K? I'm kidding. No, seriously, dude. You haven't seen this? Okay. Were you told about 10K somewhere along the line? Okay. Okay, the 8K. Now, if you were in one of my business 100 classes, you would have heard me tell you about it. But other than that, 8Ks were my bread and butter. Whenever there is some significant event in a company, it could be the death of a director, or it could be just a press release. You had to file an 8K with the SEC, simply notifying, hey, something unusual, out of the ordinary, happened. The president of the company became a Hare Krishna, and he quit, and he started his own commune. That would be an 8K filing. You'll call me conservative, but I'd file an 8K for that. I had forever these small companies who thought that if they put out a press release every week, that would boost their stock price. It didn't. It just got lame. But they'd put out these press releases through these lame press release services that charged a fee to send it nowhere. And I'd have to file an 8K for each of these. I was okay with it because I charged $50. Oh, it's just an Edgar filing. The press release was submitted on October 13th of 2002. But you want to look at these because although a lot of them are just, oh God, another press release, some of them are rather notable in terms of some event that happened. And oftentimes financial journalists who are worth their salt, they will be prowling 8Ks all the time to see what events the company has reported to the SEC. Okay? So that's something that's useful to know about. When we are financial analysts, these financial statements here are just the beginning of our story. This is the end of the accounting story. The accountant has done his or her job. He or she can go out for Miller beer. This is when our job begins. But it does not end with just looking at these statements. We have to look at the notes. We have to look at these filings with the SEC. And even there is just the beginning of our work. We then have to start to think, what does all this mean? We have routines. We have things that we do, sort of like ritual, to get things in order for our purposes. But at the end of the day, we then have to ask the question, what does this mean? What do all these numbers mean? I was going to tell you one more thing here. Oh, I know why. Form 10K. Now, you were told about the Form 10K. Here's the parts of a Form 10K that are important. Actually, there's a lot important in it. The financial statements will be in there. The K's will carry the financial statements. Not only this year's, but they'll carry back some years. Now, the other thing that will be in there that is very useful to us in a 10K filing is the MD&A. The management discussion and analysis. The management discussion and analysis. It is a section of the 10K, and it is useful. In the old days, we created boilerplates, and then we would just pump these things out, just standardized language words. And then the SEC got into this plain language thing back in my time as a consultant in the 1990s. And they finally imposed a plain language rule. We could no longer use boilerplate legalese. these. We had to make these documents accessible to and readable by an average investor. I was actually opposed to this, and I filed a formal opinion with a lot of other people saying, this is bad news. For one thing, it made my work a lot harder. I had to actually type things up. But it also bothered me, the idea that we were making these documents so that average hillbillies could read them and think they understood what was going on. The last thing that I wanted was some fool from Decatur, someone who should not be investing. Well, I can read this. It's not legalese, so it must be something I could invest in. I don't want that, because underneath it, it is still a technical document. You can make it as user-friendly as you want, but under the hood, it's still Windows. Sorry. A little attack on Bill Gates. You see, we don't want people investing, but that's neither here nor there. Look, the MD&A. These days, it can be a very glib document. The management, the writers of this, and I can still write MD&As. I have to have them. I can do it shadow. We can be very honest with you in these documents. We can tell you the truth, or we can tell you just objectively. Yeah, we're going to get pressure, and in bad companies, there will be thumbscrews put to the MD&A writers to say things that are good and to downplay the bad. Yeah, that's going to happen. But at the end of the day, the MD&A writers can tell you a story. Sometimes they'll tell it to you quite honestly. Sometimes they might have to couch their language. Sometimes they might blow smoke up your ass. But at the end of the day, it's a good way to see what the management itself is thinking. And they address the financial statements. They say, hey, look at this. And over here, we see a problem on this. And here, this has improved over last year. And they can actually direct you. Don't let them focus you. But let them direct you. Have a look at this. This was an issue for us for several years, and we were criticized for this. Now we have worked on this, and our liquidity ratios, for example, have improved considerably. And you can look at the financial statements for yourself and say, well, yeah, they have. Not really as much as you're making it out, but you're right. So the MD&A is of great use to us. What I'm trying to do is, as I drop into accounting for a while here, I'm trying to keep your eyes on the sunlight. Is that, yeah, we do some number crunching in this class, but at the end of the day, the number crunching is just so that we can get some stuff that we can use for our analytical skills, which is what financial analysis, which is what finance is all about. Finance is part accounting, part economics, but it's also something very different from either of them, because we follow very disciplined procedures, and then we apply our sense. And sometimes the best sense you have is not your calculator, is not in your calculator. It's that common sense. Now, wait a minute. This doesn't look right. Or this doesn't pass the smell test. Or I've seen a trend over a period of several years. See, in finance, and here I'm starting to sneak, I'm starting to slide you into the technical part. One of the financial statements is the statement of cash flows. That tells us what the company has been using cash for, what the company has been gathering cash from. And at the end, you see, has the company spun off cash, or has it absorbed cash in a given year? Now, 1 year doesn't tell you, well, I suppose if a company absorbed, it used on net $500 million worth of cash, that'd be a bad sign, okay? If you ran a negative cash of $500 million, that's a bad sign, okay? Just between you and me. But more than anything else, 1 year doesn't tell you tremendous amounts unless it's really dramatic. What you want to do is look over a period of years. How has this company been doing? Has it been generally spinning off cash, or has it been generally absorbing cash? In other words, has this company been drawing down its liquid assets over a period of years, or has it been building up liquid assets over a period of years? That would be useful. We could also look inside of the statement of cash flows and say, okay, here's a company that has been essentially eating up its capital base for years and years and years. We saw that with automakers. The writing was on the wall for years that some of the automakers were essentially living by cannibalizing themselves. That it was right there. Anyone could have seen it, that sooner or later there would be an end to this. Now, here's where it gets even a little more complicated, though. A company is spinning off cash every year, and it's spinning off more and more cash. In other words, it's bringing in more dollars than it is spending in real cash terms. So that its cash is building and building and building year over year over year. That's a good sign, right?
Right.
Wrong. Why is it a bad sign?
Depends on where the cash is coming from.
Well, let's say it's coming from operations. This company is just operating well. It sells stuff. It spends money on the production of its merchandise. And every year, it keeps accumulating more and more cash. Why would that be a bad thing? You want to throw a lifeline? Oh, I love it when you talk dirty like that, yes. You see, this is a company. Are you telling me that cash put in the bank is the best thing you can do with your money? Really? This is investors' money. If you can't figure out some way to use that cash to give a high return on investment to the shareholders, then give it to the damn shareholders. You do a special dividend. Give it all to them. You don't have any way to figure out what to do with that. Sooner or later, you are going to die, sucker, because you are not using that cash to push your company forward. No, I don't want to see someone just gathering cash. I'm rich, swimming cash. That cash could be working for you. That cash could be doing for you. Yes, I do want you to have liquidity. I want you to have a strong liquidity base. But if you are building cash reserves more and more every year, that tells me that you don't have any idea of anything that you could do with that cash. Dude, I know a lot of great things to do with cash, okay? Have you ever met someone who has way too much money for his own good? I've known a lot of people like that. I mean, come on, man. Give it to me. I'll show you. I've got some good things to do with it. Really. Some of the investments are maybe not so legal, but you see, there's the thing, though. You understand that when you look at a financial statement, it's not some linear process. This isn't law school kind of stuff. This isn't, forgive me, basic accounting kind of stuff. This is a nuanced thinking about what it means to operate a business. Similarly, if I see let me get into some of this now. Grr. Okay, the income statement. And you'll notice, by the way, in this class, it's very broad brush strokes. You can get into these income statements that have hundreds of categories. Well, they wouldn't have hundreds, but they'd have all these categories. We don't look at it that way. We talk about, look, we got the company has its revenue. And if this company is a maker of goods, then we would have a cost of goods sold. I put a COGS, I've seen a CGS too, but cost of goods sold. Now, essentially, the costs that would be in this category would be costs that could be matched up to the things that were sold. There are all kinds of costs in a company. Lord knows it seems like there's always costs. What COGS addresses, cost of goods sold addresses, is the goods, or rather the costs that can be at least to some extent identifiably matched with a sale, a cost that is matched to a sale. And so if we have that kind of a structure in a company, we would have revenue minus cost of goods sold is gross. You'll hear me use the word gross for this, and I do apologize. Sometimes I get a little bit, this is gross income or gross profit, whatever. Now, if this is a service company, you would not see a COGS probably. A lot of companies, you just won't see that line. So it's nice when it's there because it can tell us some things, but if it's not there, don't think the financial statement is all whacked. It just would mean that this company doesn't have a revenue stream where what it sells can be matched up to something that brought that cost money to bring that sale about. Okay. Now, from there, you just get your... and I'll just do this. In one order or another, minus your sales and administrative expenses. Now, this is accounting, by the way. This is accounting. This does not mean that cash went out the door. As a matter of fact, you could have a nice fat number there and no cash, it might have been, no cash was burned up. You cost me $10, well, in your case, $5 an hour. You work 40 hours, okay, so I owe you $200, right? I can expense that, but hey, you know, I'll pay you next week. We have a holding period for your paycheck to make sure that you're not going to take off on us. So, yeah, I could write that. There could be $200 on there, and there's no cash goes out. So you have to be appreciating right now that the financial statement, as it is presented to you here in the income statement, does not tell you the story of the cash that is flowing in this company. Okay, now the other one that will be in here is depreciation. Now, the sales and administrative expense, this in reality, this is going to have a lot of categories to it, subcategories, wages and salaries, electric bills, utilities, advertising expense, whatever. There's going to be a lot of detail in here. One thing that we like to do is in finance is we'll collapse that into a lump number, and then later we might bring it back out and tease the details out. But first, we'd like to see what the big number is, S&A expenses or whatever it is. Now, again, depreciation. There has never been a company that has actually written a check payable to depreciation. It's never happened. Truth be told, I had an old professor who said he once thought about changing his name to depreciation so they could send the check to someone. There is no such thing as depreciation as a cash flow item. So remember that when we get to what we need in finance, we are going to have to add that number back in because it never went out the door as money out of the pocket. Depreciation didn't. Now, once you have gotten to this, you've got your operating income, what we call EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, interest before earnings and taxes. EBIT. Now, also, by the way, depreciation, there's another thing that could happen here called amortization. Sort of like a kind of depreciation too, but one way or t'other, that's EBIT. Now, one thing that you'll see sometimes mentioned EBITDA, which is earnings before, something that we kind of sometimes do is we take the operating income we see and we add back in depreciation and amortization. It's just sort of like a flashpoint number for us to have a quick look at. It takes away one of those non-cash, some of that non-cash stuff. It doesn't fix everything we need to have fixed, but it gives us at least a more realistic picture, a little bit more realistic picture of what was going on with cash money itself. There are still significant problems with EBIT that adding depreciation and amortization back in doesn't fix, but it gives us a little bit more of a picture that talks about cash flow rather than accounting numbers. Okay, now we're going to take out the interest that the company is paying on its debts. And we get to EBT, earnings before taxes. Cautioning again here that when you subtract out the interest, that does not mean that you actually wrote a check for that number. If you saw $10,000 there, that does not necessarily mean the $10,000 went out of a checking account somewhere. It's possible that you owed the money at the time that you produced this financial statement. So you would recognize it on the financial statement, but you don't pay the money for another month or 2 months. So what happens, you see, is that the interest is actually incurred, but the cash outflow did not occur. So again, another caution, watch it. And then you take out your taxes. And on Thursday, I will talk to some extent about taxes, and you get your net income, net. You'll hear me call it net, your net income. Now, from here, we can talk about earnings per share. You take the net income and you divide it by the number of shares outstanding, common shares. That would be your EPS, your earnings per share. Just take net income divided by the number of shares outstanding. Where can you see the number of shares outstanding? It should be right there in the balance sheet. It should actually be listed on a line in the balance sheet by the number for the common stock. So you can divide net income by the earnings per share and see what's going on there. EPS, here's a rule. EPS should be positive. As a general rule, we like to see EPS positive. But if your net income is negative, it obviously won't be, and all bets are off. Now, once I've taken the net income, once I've got net income, I'm going to, and I do appreciate that this is really review for a lot of you, I'm going to take out my dividends. And the result will be the change in retained earnings. Which flows to the balance sheet in the owner's equity section. This is why, long ago when I taught accounting, I said something that I got my head eaten off a couple of times for. Really, the income statement is nothing but a giant nodule in the balance sheet. The income statement is actually just a really detailed little sidebar calculation of the balance sheet. Because at the end of the day, everything you're doing in the income statement is to the purpose of getting this number, the change in retained earnings, so that when I say here in the owner's equity section of the balance sheet, I say, what were the retained earnings at the beginning? And I would look at last year's balance sheet to get that. Beginning of the accounting period, be it a year, a quarter, a month, whatever, plus the change in retained earnings that I get from right here. If that's a negative, then it's a subtraction, and that would be the retained earnings at the end. So really, at the end of the day, the income statement is just like a giant sidebar calculation in the flow of the balance sheet. It's just a big thing we do as a calculation so we can get this one last number here, our change in retained earnings, that we add to the retained earnings at the beginning of the accounting period to get our retained earnings at the end of the accounting period. Okay? Now here's another quick point. I have actually heard this. It's not folklore. When someone says, well, when a business person says, well, we'll just take that out of retained earnings, or we'll do this project from our retained earnings. That is as dumb as the statement can get. There is no such thing in reality as retained earnings. There is nothing. There is no checking account called retained earnings. There's no room called retained earnings. Retained earnings is nothing but an accounting device we use to keep track of how much we have accumulated in incomes since the company began. It doesn't mean that there is anything like that. I've seen retained earnings that were huge and the company went bankrupt. The retained earnings can be big and the company can take a dirt nap because cash isn't there. Retained earnings is just the end result of how much you've been building net income, less dividends over the years. And you could do that over and over and over and over again, year after year after year, and to the very time that you crashed and burned. So we have to keep that in mind in financial analysis. Now, balance sheet. Let the fun begin. Okay, the balance sheet is assets and liabilities. Now the liabilities and the owner's equity should equal the assets, as I mentioned previously. We should hope so. And I might be the only person on earth but who had this problem, but maybe I'm not. The worst thing that in accounting is when you try to get the numbers to match and they don't. There were times when I actually thought about changing my major to philosophy because I couldn't get those numbers. I had an old accountant who taught me at the grad level who one day said, well, if all else fails, why don't you add the page number to one side, see what happens? And he had a deadpan look on his face. He was serious. He said, yes, I know. Sometimes you just can't get the damn things to match. You just cannot get matching. But somewhere along the line, the accountants, bless their brave souls, managed to get liabilities plus owner's equity to equal assets. Now, on the asset side, there's current assets and there are long-term assets. On the liability side, there are current liabilities and there are long-term liabilities. And these can get quite detailed. Interestingly, in this textbook, and this is not just this textbook, I've seen this in actual practice, we see more emphasis on the currents here than we do on the long terms. We'll do this broad brushstroke on the currents. On the long terms. We'll say, well, here's your gross fixed assets, and then minus accumulated depreciation, and that would be your net fixed assets. And there's your long-term assets right there. There it is right there. And obviously the change in accumulated depreciation from year to year would be the same as what you're seeing here in a given year. So if it went from $60,000 to $75,000 from 2005 to 2006, you damn well better see a $15,000 right there in the depreciation line on the income statement. Okay? But it's a very broad brushstroke that we do in financial analysis. Later we can look in, well, what kinds of fixed assets were these? Were these buildings? Were these? What was in there? That kind of detail. But for the short term, for a quick introduction, Same with long term. Really, in long term, long term liabilities, we mostly focus on debt. debt, like bonds. It can get complicated as hell in there, trying to figure out how the debt moved around sometimes. Also appreciating, remember how I told you that with corporate bonds, they don't pay the bond off until the very end. The principal. They just pay the coupons along the way. Well, interestingly enough, most bonds, matter of fact, I'd say probably almost every bond on earth, there's a covenant that requires that the company build a reserve year over year over year so that when the long-term debt matures, the money's there to pay it. In other words, they're not going to let the company borrow $10 million and then wait till for 20 years and then wait to year 20 to sweat out the $10 million it owes. There will be some requirement that a pool be building over time. Also, in more modern accounting, they, in the long-term liabilities and things like that, they want some recognition of exposures, risk exposures. So there, this can long-term liabilities can get really complicated, weirdly complicated sometimes. And you have to look at the notes of the financial statements to figure out how they did what they did. But for our purposes right now, long-term liabilities is long-term debt. Up here in current, like I said, the focus in this course, and quite often with a lot of financial analysts, is in the currents, what we call the liquidities. The liquidity is up here. Current assets indicate liquidity, gross liquidity. That's stuff that you could sell reasonably fast. Look, inventory, yeah, I could probably, if I was desperate, I could get rid of my inventory tomorrow. Sell it to Odlot. Well, Odlot's went out of business. Sell it to some broker. My accounts receivable, there are companies that will buy receivables. So if I really needed money, I could sell my receivables. So the current assets do give us a sense of liquidity. The current liabilities also give us a sense of our more immediate exposures to cash outflow. So in the current assets, we would have, obviously, cash. And you would also have, sometimes you'll see it listed together, marketable securities. That could be things like money market mutual funds, things like that. Things that could be turned into cash very quickly for the company's purposes. A company that just has cash in the vault, that's crazy. At least put the damn stuff in an account that earns a little interest. Okay, now also in the current assets, you would have accounts receivable, obviously. Accounts receivable. You would also have inventory. You would also have prepaid expenses. In other words, a lot of companies want all their money up front, even though you're not getting any benefit from all right away. Like insurance, I'd have to pay a year's premiums, but I would probably expense those out only on a monthly basis. So if I pay $12,000 in insurance premiums, in February, I would have a prepaid expense of $11,000 on my balance sheet. You got that one? If I had paid $12,000 for an insurance premium for the year, in February of that year, I would have $11,000 of a prepaid expense asset. I would have expensed $1,000 of it for the month of January. And so there'd still be essentially, I got me this money on deposit somewhere kind of thing. It's almost like this is sort of like a reserve. If I had to, I'd go and beat up the insurance agent and get my money back. I shouldn't say that. That was harsh. Am I forgetting? No, I think those are the biggies. Okay, now here on the current liability side, obviously the biggie is accounts payable. You have paid a lot of bills. Rather, you have incurred money, but the cash outflow has not occurred. So I might have bought $5,000 worth of equipment. So I expense the $5,000. If I haven't sent them the check yet, that's an account payable. So I would have to think about that in terms of cash flow. Yeah, it was an expense for an accountant, but not for the company yet. That's why you delay paying your bills. Me, I've been working on a 5-year plan. Oh, the crowd gets humorless when we do finance. This kind of sucks the blood out of you, but trust me, it's a short-term thing. Look, accounts payable are a biggie. Notes payable are another one. And I have to be careful here because I've been telling you, well, bills are short-term, notes are intermediate-term, and bonds are long-term. Well, here we call notes payable, things that are due, anything that's due in less than a year, that's a note payable. It's like your IOUs. It's quick working capital loans from your bank. Were you exposed? Let me try this. Were you guys exposed to the idea of working capital management accounts in banks? You're looking at me. Say what? Okay. Here's the trick. Look, a whole lot of companies make most of their revenue in just a couple of months of the year, the Christmas season. The rest of the year, they suck wind. And so what banks do is they have this very cool trick. It's been around forever. And that's one of the bad things is now the banks are not doing this like they have always done. But the way it worked was essentially the bank would have an account where you as a business person could draw down this line of credit month over month from January, February, and then it's clear through maybe October. And then when the money started rolling in from your sales, Christmas sales, you would be paying off that money that you had been borrowing on the line of credit through the year. To the point where essentially it works out and there's all these calculations we can do in a finance course. But at the end of the year, it's kind of balanced itself out so that during the year in the lean times, during the months of lean times, you were drawing down this line of credit. And then during the fat months, those few fat months of Christmas, you were paying off the bill that you had been, the loan that you had been working on with the bank all those months through the year. That's why, as business people, we are so excited about the Christmas season, because that doesn't mean just cash in the drawer. That means we can pay off the damn bank that's been lending us money all these months to keep us going. Very real, very likely. I shouldn't say it is likely that if you work for a lot of businesses that are like retailers, when you get your check in, let's say August, your paycheck, that paycheck was not earned by the company. That was a loan from the bank. And the company is going to pay off that loan and all the other borrowed money it has accumulated through the year at the end of the year through the Christmas sales season. That's how a lot of companies do it. Another thing that often happens is what a phenomenon is called floor planning. Companies, oftentimes boat companies are a great example of this. They have to, or furniture companies, they borrow money so that they can fill their stock room with merchandise. And then as they sell that merchandise, of course, they've got money for themselves, but they're also paying off the bank that did the floor planning for them. So every year, possibly every 6 months, if it's a seasonal business of some kind, maybe even more often than that, the company is borrowing a bunch of money from the bank, which would show off in notes payable, and then as it sells its floor inventory, it pays off the loan to the bank, and that would be a pay down of the notes payable. This is all called working capital management to a certain extent. Cash management schemes, you can actually work these out. They got spreadsheets to do it now. It used to be kind of a pain in the ass, but you take these to your bank and you say, this is how our business works. This is the ebb and flow of our cash. Will you provide the line of credit so that we can level this thing out? And in the old days, the bank would say, well, sure. These days, the banks are saying, screw you. That's why some of these businesses you've seen, they just went belly up. It wasn't so much because they were bad. It was just that no bank was in the business of extending the credit lines they'd been doing for years. And so these companies essentially just went tap city right away. We can't put our inventory in for the Christmas season. We're done. Game over. And then, of course, you have the analysts saying, well, these companies just didn't plan themselves. No, it was the credit crunch that killed some of these companies. The banks didn't do what they'd always done before. So keep that in mind when you hear the story that the news media tells you, that there's a story behind it sometimes. Oh, a mother's work is never done. Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't know. There's one here. One last one that I'll put here is accumulated expenses. When I had paid you, you had earned the money from me, and I hadn't paid you yet, well, I really did suffer because I didn't pay you. How did I suffer? I had to put the $200 here. Okay? See, the $200 occurred here, like I had paid you, but I didn't really pay you, so I've got to put it here too. So I match a $200 in the accumulated expenses with an S&A expense of $200. Well, what happens when I do finally get around to paying you? What do I do then? Well, then I just match cash and account accumulated expenses. So that essentially it's always working like a lockstep. First it goes boom, boom, and then at the end, cash and accumulated expenses. So that's how it works. But again, notice, that if I am going to see this number as a financial analyst, I need to also see this number. If I'm going to see the sales and administrative expense as a financial analyst, I also need to see what's happening over here in accumulated expenses as a financial analyst. So I'll know how much of that was real cash that went out. If I saw $200 negative on the sales and administrative expense, and I saw $200 pop up in the accumulated expenses, I'd know there's no change as far as cash goes. But if I saw accumulated expenses suddenly drop by $200, I'd say, now cash has gone out. And in our world, cash is king. Cash is what we care about. Cash is what we love. And no, money is not the root of all happy. Money cannot buy you happiness, but until you find something that can, money is a damn good proxy. Where the hell was I? That's the story of it. The only thing that's left to tell of this story is how we take this stuff. And this was just like a real sloppy review. I'm assuming that you all survived your accounting. You're all pretty much still okay. You might have had some therapy, whatever. And I'm just sort of giving you a broad brushstroke. In a sense, though, what I'm doing is I'm showing you how we as financial analysts look at this. These are this broad brushstroke approach that we use, not really wanting to know how the trial balances were put together, not really wanting to know how the matching came about so that assets did indeed equal liabilities plus owner's equity. What we care about is just that these statements have been prepared. This is what they generally look like. And then, at the end of the day, what we then want to look at is the statement of cash flows, which is actually very easy because, in a sense, and the book does just a wonderful job of this. It just puts down two financial statements, the income statements and the balance sheets, for 2 years, just side by side, and then it just looks at the pluses and minuses. What changed? Was this a plus? Was this a minus? So we would look at, accounts receivable for 2006, we would look at AR. 2006, accounts receivable was $50,000. 2007, accounts receivable was $40,000. So we know that we have had an increase of $10,000 in accounts receivable. That's all this is about. All you do is just line up the stupid statements. Don't make this complicated, for God's sake. Now, they do divide it. There is the cash changes in cash from operating activities, from investment activities, and from financing activities. Yeah, I'll show you that by example. I'll do that on Thursday. I'll show you that by example. But really, all you're doing is you're just lining up two statements, hoping to God the same categories are there in both years, which I've actually run into where they changed a category or two, and it drove me crazy. But one way or the other, all we're doing is we're just looking at the changes that have happened. And that tells us, okay, if accounts receivable went from $50,000 in 2006 to $40,000 in 2007, that tells us that we generated it as a source of cash from our activities, $10,000. That's cash that flowed in. That was a net inflow. But on the other hand, if I see that my accumulated expenses went from $4,000 down to $3,000, that means that some stupid person in the company paid a bill. He got paid a few months of his paycheck. Yeah, matter of fact, that would have been 5 weeks. Finally, someone paid you. Okay. See, that would be, in other words, that would be a negative just by the common sense. Oh, well, our accumulated expenses went down, so some idiot paid someone something. Okay. And that's the way we approach it in finance, is we just say, all right, what went up, what went down? And at the end of the day, we add up the numbers and we say, okay, we either had a net cash inflow, we were generating cash, or we had a net cash outflow, we were absorbing cash. And that tells us something very important about the company, because if the company is having cash go out more than it goes in, and that happens more than once or twice, if it just keeps happening, that company is in serious trouble. But at the same time, as I noted before, bigger positive is not always better. We have to look at the nuances of it. We have to look at the patterns and the levels and the changes. And that's what we do in finance. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.